5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hey everyone, I'm Sam.
And I'm Sean.
And this is Key to the Case. Thank you all for tuning in to this week's case. We have a bittersweet update to share with you all. We are going to take the pressure off having a schedule for the podcast and only publish episodes when we have adequate time for it. So we are not quitting by any means, but we can't maintain the schedule we have now for much longer, even after reducing it to every other week. I said it's bittersweet, and that's because I see this as an opportunity to work on cases I've always wanted to research, but felt like I didn't have the proper amount of time. So I plan to start diving into those cases without the pressure of a specific timeline. It's bitter, of course, because I know podcasts thrive on consistency and schedules. And as a listener, I'm sure you prefer when you can have an expectation for when we put out episodes. But this also means we won't be able to get to as many unsolved cases and get those cases out there. So this is hard, but it's the right decision for us at this time.
Yeah. And with that said, if you haven't already, you should subscribe to get notifications for when we drop a new episode, because, you know, like Sam said, it's not going to be on a consistent schedule. So when we do get around to recording an episode, you'll know right away when it gets posted.
Right. And it might not always be on Sundays, like we've always posted. If we have an episode ready on a Tuesday, for example, we would just go ahead and publish it, not wait until Sunday to do that. All right. Let's get into this week's case. Lisa McBride was 27 years old at the time of her murder in 1990. Lisa grew up in New Jersey with one brother and remained in New Jersey for her short life. Lisa lived a fulfilling life. Her father, George, told the Star-Ledger that she had a close-knit group of friends with whom she spent much of her time, whether attending concerts, hiking, riding ATVs, or whatever the activity, they knew how to have fun together. Lisa was social, exuberant, caring, and fun-loving, but she also had a strong sense of independence and enjoyed her freedom. She lived alone in a quaint home she had recently purchased in Highland Lakes, a small unincorporated community in Vernon Township within Sussex County, New Jersey. There, Lisa spent time working on house projects and, you know, buying a home on her own was something she was quite proud of. She wanted to know that she could purchase and maintain a home on her own. She didn't want to wait to have someone to do that with, and she did it. Lisa worked as an executive secretary at a local bank where she had been employed for several years and was known as a reliable, responsible employee who excelled at her job. Outside of work, Lisa used her background in dance to teach ballet to children at a local school of dance. She took in stray cats and took care of her own cats, who were really like her children, according to Lisa's family. Lisa was close with her family, making regular visits to see her parents, and just recently before she disappeared, she had become the godmother to her brother's daughter. So I mentioned that Lisa enjoyed attending concerts with her friends. She was especially fond of country music. So it was no surprise when on Friday, June 22nd, 1990, Lisa had plans to go to a country and Western concert after work. That evening, she made the approximately 50-mile or 80-kilometer drive from Highland Lakes to Beacon Theater in New York City, where she met up with three friends, and the group had a good time at the concert. Now, I presume that Lisa's friends were from the same part of New Jersey as her, because after the concert, they visited one of Lisa's favorite spots, John's Big Pub in Newfoundland. And this pub was about 20 minutes from her home. Lisa and her friends arrived at the pub around 12:30 a.m. There, Lisa had a few beers and reconnected with old friends she happened to run into, giving them her phone number so they could stay in touch. It was a typical night for Lisa. When her friends later reflected on the evening, they could not recall anything out of the ordinary. There were no strange encounters throughout the night. Lisa left the pub around 1:15 or 1:30 a.m., telling her friends she needed to get home because she had to work later that day or later that morning, rather. Now, sources vary a bit on this next piece of information as far as the timing goes, but Lisa's coworkers at the bank began to worry when she didn't show up that morning. Some sources said that one of her coworkers attempted to call her at 7:30 a.m. to see where she was, while most sources from around the time this happened indicated that they began to feel concerned around 9 a.m. when she still hadn't shown up. Regardless, Lisa did not make it to work that day, and that was, of course, highly unusual for her. She was not known to have unexpected absences. If she needed to miss work, she would let someone know. So her coworkers called Lisa's home repeatedly to no avail. Then they contacted either Lisa's parents or brother, neither of whom knew where Lisa might be. Her brother, Doug, ultimately decided to go to Lisa's house to check on her around 10 a.m.
Did anyone try to contact the friends she was out with that night?
I don't think they did before Doug went to the house, but when they did, they eventually told them that, or told people that Lisa left the bar around 1:15 or 1:30, like I mentioned, and she left alone. That's all they knew. As Doug turned on to the quiet, dead-end street where Lisa lived, he saw her car parked outside her house. Doug approached Lisa's home and received no answer when he knocked on the door. He attempted to enter her home through the front and back door, but both were locked, so he retrieved the spare key that he knew Lisa kept under the steps outside. Inside, he observed that Lisa's kitchen light was on, and that the couch in her living room, normally pushed against the wall, had been pulled out, sitting about 6 inches from the wall. After searching the house, Doug was certain that Lisa was not there, but there were some more disturbing signs throughout her home. Lisa's sheets and comforter were missing from her bed, and they were nowhere to be found in the house, so it was clear she was not in the middle of washing her bedding. Additionally, a screen on one of the windows in the home had been cut. There were these two slits on the screen, but what I don't know is if that window was unlocked, and it sounded like the screen was still on the window, but that detail is not completely clear either.
Do we know if those slits in the screen were already there, or did they seem new?
No one knew them to be there, and at first, I was like, what do these two slits mean? Because if someone wanted to break in through an unlocked window, couldn't they just pull the screen off and open the window? But maybe the screen was difficult to take down and these cuts helped them do that. Or they could have even entered through the screen because the slits were, I believe, big enough and maybe they didn't take it down at all.
I suppose depending on the size of the screen, if they did, you know, make a slit and try to enter through the screen, they probably would have just torn the whole screen out.
Yeah, it seems like at that point the screen would just pop off unless they put the screen back on the window, but then they're really taking their time and what's the point of that? Other than this window, there were no signs of a break-in, no signs of forced entry. Lisa's friends and family told the media that the phone line to Lisa's house had been cut. When Doug went back outside after these discoveries, he noticed that Lisa's car, which she usually kept locked, was unlocked. There were plenty of reasons for Doug to be concerned about Lisa's absence, so he reported her as a missing person to the local police. Interestingly, and I'm jumping ahead here momentarily, but when the Sussex County prosecutor initially spoke about Lisa's disappearance, he disputed the claims that Lisa's phone line had been cut, saying that there was no conclusive proof of damage to the wires. He also indicated that there were no clear signs of a struggle in Lisa's house, nor were there signs of forced entry or that anything had been stolen. Her purse, which contained her checkbook, some personal items, and a keychain that said Wisa, which was Lisa's childhood nickname, were missing. So I guess you could say those items were stolen or that they were on Lisa's person when something happened to her. But it's not as though someone ransacked her house. I believe what may have happened here is that Lisa's family and friends were sharing information with the media early on that law enforcement did not want to come out and that they were sort of attempting to retract some of those statements. It could be something else, but that's how it read to me. Lisa's disappearance seemed to be treated with urgency from the outset. This was not an area that was accustomed to disappearances or murders. When the investigators spoke with Lisa's neighbors, they learned that one of them spotted her arriving home around 1:45 or 2 a.m., which does align with the time she left the bar and how long the drive home would have been. The witness was actually not quite Lisa's neighbor. He was visiting his parents who lived on the same street as Lisa. His dad had picked him up from a bus stop and they had just arrived back at the dad's house and he was walking the family dog when he spotted Lisa. And I know what you're probably thinking, that it was a strange time to walk a dog. And I agree. But I don't know if he was actually on a walk with the dog or he was just letting it out to go to the bathroom and that turned into he was walking the dog in the reporting.
Yeah, maybe he didn't have like a fenced in backyard, so he had to let the dog out on a leash out front and it looked like he was walking the dog, but maybe he was just letting, like you said, letting it go to the bathroom on a leash.
Right. All we know is that he was outside with the dog out front and that's presumably why he saw what he saw, but he didn't see much of note. He just saw Lisa getting out of her car, going inside her home alone, and flicking some lights on. There was no reasonable explanation anyone could think of that Lisa would have taken off. Her family was adamant that she would not have left her cats behind. Lisa's parents, George and Norma, took in one of her cats, but the other was actually missing. This cat was described as skittish and particularly fearful of men, and I don't know if they ever found this cat. It's very possible that if something happened inside Lisa's home, the cat may have gotten out of the house somehow out of fear and took off. While Lisa's family wanted to maintain hope that she was out there somewhere, they knew their daughter and knew she wasn't the type to leave like this, and considering the scene at her home, they believed she was likely abducted. The search for Lisa kicked off and it was expansive. This encompassed the area around Lisa's home, including the lakes. Recall she lived in Highland Lake, so Highland Lake was searched, but there were other bodies of water nearby that were searched too. Lisa's home was also not far from the massive Wai Wai Yanda State Park, so they searched the parts of the state park closest to Highland Lakes. Search dogs and helicopters were deployed to no avail. Hundreds of people were interviewed early on, even within the first month, including the people Lisa went out with the night before she vanished, and they were ruled out as suspects. The investigators found nothing to connect them to Lisa's disappearance. And if we are to believe what the witness reported, he saw Lisa arrive home alone. So it doesn't appear that after she said goodbye to her friends, she left with someone else or even with one of the friends. Now, that doesn't mean someone didn't follow her, but if someone did follow her, again, the neighbor didn't see anyone pull up to her house. A 17-member task force made up of state, county, and local law enforcement investigators was formed to work on Lisa's case. And a little bit later, the FBI even got involved. One lead that came up during their investigation related back to a man Lisa told her friends had been pestering her. Several months before Lisa disappeared, she indicated to some of her friends that she feared someone might be following her. It's unclear how this man became familiar with Lisa. For all we know, Lisa may not have even known how he found her, but he had reportedly asked Lisa out on a date about 6 months before she vanished. And on another occasion, he waited for her in the parking lot of the bank she worked at until she got off and left flowers on her car. He even showed up at her favorite pub when she was there. It seemed that Lisa was uninterested in this individual, but still, he persisted. The problem was, no one knew who this man was. The people she told about these encounters, namely her friends, didn't know or remember the man's name. Lisa didn't tell her family about the situation, so they couldn't be of help either.
Yeah, maybe she just didn't want to worry her family by telling them about this guy.
Right, that's what they presumed, that Lisa wouldn't want them to be concerned for her safety. And she didn't report it to the police either. So she probably felt she had a handle on the situation, or at least that the police wouldn't be able to help much. This topic was reported rather frequently in articles about Lisa's case, and we will come back to it later. But for a long time, the police were trying desperately to find out who this man was, because on paper, he sounded like a very solid suspect. At the very least, he was someone they needed to speak with. In October 1990, several months after Lisa disappeared, the task force disbanded because they were essentially in the same spot they were months ago. So with little movement, they could no longer justify putting all of those resources toward Lisa's disappearance. At the same time, they wanted to spread more awareness about her case. Maybe they hadn't reached a broad enough audience, and as hunting season was approaching, as grim as it was, they needed hunters to be on the lookout for Lisa. She could be anywhere. Spreading awareness was key, and it wasn't just about finding Lisa, but even her missing purse or keychain could be a step in the right direction. It would be information that they didn't have before. So yeah, getting the message out there that Lisa and some of her belongings were still missing was critical. In mid-October 1990, Lisa's family, friends, and volunteers were gearing up for a big search when they received the news that a hunter had come upon badly decomposed remains. The remains were in a dense thicket under a cherry tree in a secluded area of Sandiston Township, about 40 yards off Old Mine Road within the Delaware Water Gap National Recreation Area. And to be clear, the body could not be seen from the road due to how overgrown it was there. All of that to say, this location was about a 50-minute drive from Lisa's home. There weren't many missing women in that area at that time, so there was reason to believe that the remains could belong to Lisa. So Lisa's dental records were obtained, and after the comparisons were complete, later that day, the day she was found, it was confirmed that this was Lisa's body. And the area she was in was unfamiliar to those who knew her, and no one knew Lisa to ever visit that area. The location was also not on the radar of the people who were about to do the big search for Lisa. They would have been in a completely different area, so it would have been fruitless. The Sussex County prosecutor revealed that Lisa's body was nude when she was found. And although she was concealed in the sense that you couldn't see her easily from the road, whoever put her there did not attempt to conceal or bury her body. It was clear that Lisa had been exposed to the elements for quite some time, likely for the duration of time she was missing, which by that point was about 4 months. So determining a cause of death could be difficult. It took quite a while for any details around this to come out, but Lisa's death certificate indicated that she died due to homicide from external violence. And later reports said that she may have died from blunt force trauma. Her left cheekbone was fractured, but as far as I could find, her official cause of death is labeled as undetermined. And I also couldn't find any information one way or the other about if she had been sexually assaulted. I imagine at that point, with how decomposed she was, it could have been difficult to make that determination. Lisa's family said that alongside the anguish of this news, there was this sense of relief. Their long, agonizing uncertainty about where Lisa might be had finally ended, and they could now lay her to rest. At the same time, the news shattered those shreds of hope they had held on to that she might still be alive. The area surrounding Lisa's body was searched thoroughly after the discovery, and the investigators found what they described as a significant piece of evidence near her body, but would not share what exactly they found. It makes sense that they would hold this back. It's likely something that only the killer would know about. But with all the time that has passed in this case, you wonder if it would be helpful for them to release that information now. Maybe it's something the public could help with, but also it very well may not be. Interestingly, there were some varied opinions about the location in which Lisa was found. A park ranger described the area as one most commonly traveled by hunters, but he noted that the person who disposed of Lisa's body would not necessarily have needed to be familiar with the location because it's near the Delaware River and the Dingman's Ferry Bridge. According to this ranger, someone could have simply pulled off the road and assumed they were in a very remote area. Others who have remarked about the case, specifically this location, however, disagree and believe the person responsible was likely familiar with the isolated road off which her body was recovered. Without having local knowledge myself, it's hard to have an opinion on this piece, but it does feel like the killer has local knowledge because of the location of Lisa's home. She lived on this dead-end road among some other homes, but the community itself had only a few ways in and out and was described as not easy for drivers to get around. It doesn't really look like an area you would just pass through to get to some other location. But even if you were, how would a random killer know to target Lisa's house and that a single woman would be there? It makes far more sense that this person knew Lisa personally or knew her from afar, whether that be someone who lived in her community or maybe she had a stalker. That seems to make more sense than this being random, and that aligns with what Lisa's family believes. Some of Lisa's friends speculated that her killer had been waiting for her in her home, attacked her when she got there, and then drove her to the location where they disposed of her. It's certainly an interesting theory and one that's possible. Maybe Lisa's killer got into her home through a window when she was out at the concert or the pub, cutting her phone line while there.
Maybe they knew about the spare key that Lisa had, and that's how they got in the home. I suppose cutting the window screen may have just been to throw the scent off, I guess. Because you said it was just under her doormat, right?
It was under the steps outside. And I don't know how tucked away it was, but I think it's an interesting theory because if, like, we don't know how many people knew about this spare key, but let's say only a few people knew that Lisa had this spare key under her steps, I can see why then you would want to make it look like you got in through a window instead of using that key, right? But then we know, okay, they put it back in its normal spot, if that is what happened.
Yeah, and the entire house was locked up when her brother got there. So they must have, if they did use a spare key, they must have locked up after themselves.
Right. It always baffles me when this happens in cases where they lock up the house on their way out. But I will say, so Lisa's keys, I believe, were also missing. So they could have just used her house keys or, yeah, they could have, if they knew about this spare key, they could have used that spare key and then put it back in its spot. So I remember when I was researching this case, when I got to the part about her couch being pulled from the wall, I thought, that's strange. Like, I'll put a pin in that and come back to it later and maybe have an idea of why the couch was pulled from the wall. But I realized I got to the end of my research and had no idea what this couch had to do with anything. So did you have any theories on why or how the couch plays into this? Or you think it's more so just a red herring?
Yeah, so you said there were no signs of a struggle within the house. I could see how the couch being pulled out, I think you said 6 inches from the wall, could be potentially seen as a struggle. Like maybe in the commotion, you know, while this killer was trying to get her, they bumped into the couch and shifted it 6 inches off the wall. Maybe she was on the couch and they tried to pull her off.
But yeah.
I don't know, or it could be nothing.
I was just thinking maybe they attacked her on the couch and during that process, they dropped something behind it and then went to pick it up, needed to pick up whatever that was. If they had something in their hand that they were attacking her with, then they had to move the couch out to get that item. But again, I just don't know how the couch plays into this. And yeah, they said there were no signs of a struggle in the house, although it seems most likely that Lisa was attacked inside her home. But there's no blood that we know of. But again, I wouldn't be surprised if they were holding back some information like that because they've released very little. And you might think she was attacked on her bed because the bedding was gone. But that could have also just been something to wrap her body in.
Yeah, you'd think there'd be at least something in the home that would help the investigators and any capacity. Like, how was the killer able to get her out of the home? And I mean, you talked about how she had a broken left cheekbone. Assuming that happened in the house, you would think there'd be at least like some blood or something, unless they cleaned it up. But yeah, I just think it's so strange that there's really nothing to go off of within the house.
Right. And again, it could be that there's more to this story than they're telling us. None of Lisa's neighbors, though, saw someone around her home other than her or an out-of-place vehicle by her home or on the street, but clearly someone was there. So this person managed to go undetected. And going back to the witness who saw Lisa enter her home, as stated, he did not see another car at her house or another person, so I wonder where they parked. It seems like a risk to park a distance away, knowing that they didn't leave Lisa in her home. Did they kill her and then go get their car to transport her? Or did they live nearby so their car wouldn't have stuck out to anyone? And then it's interesting that they were willing to take on the risk of driving her body about 50 minutes away, assuming they did it that night, 50 minutes away to dispose of her. Like, it's interesting to go to the lengths to dispose of Lisa, but then not conceal her body, like not bury her body. There are numerous possibilities. Some have even questioned if Lisa's neighbor, her neighbor's son, rather, could have been involved. And then, I mean, it appears he had the opportunity, but without knowing much about him or his circumstances, it's hard to even go there. But I would have to imagine that the police have looked into that possibility.
Yeah, he seems like someone that they should probably heavily question, right? I mean, he's not really an eyewitness, but he knows more than really anyone else.
But then I think, would we have to assume that his parents covered for him as well? If they knew he did something, or did they just go to sleep immediately after picking up their son from the bus stop and he could have done something without them knowing? As far as people in Lisa's life, the investigators have not shared if there was anyone close to her who rose to the level of being a person of interest or suspect. A year after Lisa was killed, County Prosecutor Dennis O'Leary indicated that they had a strong feeling of what happened to Lisa, but it was a matter of finding the person who did it. So that made me think they might not have many solid suspects, but have an idea of how the murder played out. But I mean, Lisa was so social. She knew a lot of people. It's possible someone in her circle slipped through the cracks and escaped suspicion. How large her circle was even evidenced by her funeral. There were more than 200 people who attended the service. Also about a year after Lisa's murder, her mom, Norma, had been sorting through Lisa's belongings in her home. She came upon a scrap of paper with a license plate number written on it. To my knowledge, there was nothing written next to it. Like, there was no context there, but Norma thought it could be the license plate number of the man who had been pestering Lisa before her murder. And sure enough, that license plate was linked to that very man. It turns out one of Lisa's friends had copied it down and given it to her. The police tracked him down, and he was living out west. I don't know where, but presumably somewhere on the West Coast. And the only information out there is that he admitted that he was interested in Lisa, but had already moved out west when she was killed. And that was that. I was like, that's it? The man who was borderline stalking her, who seemed promising as far as suspects go, couldn't have been behind this? I guess that's what we are to believe. But I was thinking, are we 100% sure about his whereabouts at that time? I'm questioning this so much because they identified him a year later. We can all do a little exercise here. Could you prove where you were a year ago today? In today's world, probably. In 1990, maybe. I mean, if this man had a job that could help verify his whereabouts, I don't know. He may have had nothing to do with Lisa's murder. It is a good sign that he was forthcoming about his interest in Lisa. It just felt like it was brushed off quickly, but the police aren't going to necessarily give us the play-by-play on how they did that. The latest update I could find about Lisa's case was that in March 2022, authorities announced that a judge had approved a request from the prosecutor's office to exhume Lisa's body in an effort to obtain more evidence. Reportedly, the investigators believed an additional investigative step was necessary and that exhuming Lisa's body was required to pursue it. The exhumation took place on March 9th, 2022, and her remains were transported to the Morris Sussex Medical Examiner's Office, where the medical examiner and a state police anthropologist conducted an examination and collected relevant evidence. DNA and other materials were then submitted to a forensic laboratory in Virginia. This is a pretty big deal. To exhume a body like this is relatively uncommon. I was thinking back, I can't recall a case we've covered where this has happened, but I couldn't find any follow-up information on the results, which makes me think that this testing didn't lead anywhere because I would think we would have something by now if it did. I was disappointed to learn that Lisa's dad, George, passed away in 2015 and her mom, Norma, died in 2018. They refused to give up on the search for answers and accountability. So it's upsetting to hear that they didn't see justice served. If you have any information related to Lisa's murder, please call the Vernon Police at 973-827-6155, the prosecutor's office at 973-383-1570, or you can remain anonymous by calling the Sussex County Sheriff's Crime Stoppers tip line at 973-383-1570. 300-2746. Thank you all so much for listening. We don't know when our next episode will be out, but hopefully not too long from now. So until then, we'll say bye for now.
Bye.